everyone, and welcome back to Projector Room, our podcast, me and Gareth's podcast, where we talk about film, cinema, and TV. Show 212, and it's Wednesday, the 17th of June. And it's bloody hot, isn't it?
Me and Gareth, I think you'll find it's Gareth and I.
Oh, sorry, old chap. Gareth and I.
Be grammatically correct.
What a grammatically. You peasant. Is it hot there or is it just here?
It is pretty hot here. I noted in the car earlier, it was 22 degrees outside, which in Ireland terms, that's fucking hot, mum.
We tell you this not because we like whining, well, we do, but the main reason is that we've both got fans on, and so we will try really hard to not let Microsoft Teams recording not sound gate it, or whatever it's called, noise gate it. But if you hear some fan noise, then tough titty, turn it off and then wait till December and come back and listen to us.
Also, when it comes to whining, I do have a nice Shiraz for after the show, so let's get this done.
Right, okay then. So, projectorroom.co.uk is our website, garethmiles.com for Gareth and tedsalmon.com for me. First bit of feedback from the group, the MeWe group, that people have chucked our way, and the usual Gemini warning that we do get Gemini to summarise these to make it succinct for reading out. So, blame her if you don't like it. Chad Dixon is first on the Burrows, as the Americans would call it, the Burrows. The Boroughs.
Edinburgh.
Yeah, exactly. Edinburgh. This is a Netflix series and it's 8 episodes. And this supernatural thriller, says Chad, follows Sam Cooper, played by Alfred Molina, a grieving retired engineer moved into a seemingly utopian desert retirement community in New Mexico. Things quickly get weird. Sam starts having bizarre dreams about his late wife, and after breaking into a neighbor's house during a middle of a night emergency, witnesses a terrifying multi-legged skeletal creature probing the man's body. This sounds great already. Of course, nobody believes them at first, but as more strange events plague the neighborhood, the local seniors band together to uncover the community's dark secrets. Chad notes that the show comes from the makers of Stranger Things, trading the usual band of kids for a fantastic geriatric cast, including Gina Davis, Bill Pullman, and Alfre Woodward. He describes the vibe as deeply inspired by the Stephen King storytelling universe, packed with a straight out of the 80s storyline that's easy to follow. Chad admits he isn't usually a big fan of the supernatural horror genre. He prefers monsters that can be explained by science, but he found this one highly watchable. The body horror is mild, the performances are solid, and Molina makes for an incredibly warm, compelling lead. With 8 45 minute episodes, Chad calls it the perfect candidate for an intense weekend binge. It's also teen friendly and might just give younger viewers a whole new appreciation for the older generation. Thank you, Chad. That sounds interesting. I like the sound of the multi-legged skeletal creature probing the man's body. I'll have to watch it just for that, I think.
Yeah, you love a good probe, don't you? It's a great cast, absolutely. Alfred Molina's always great. He's a quality actor. And Clark Peters as well. Yeah, very good, yeah. I'll be all over this.
Looks good. And I think I might give it a go. And yeah. Good shout, Chad.
Cool. Chad has also watched Tuner, which is a contemporary drama set in New York. Leo Woodall is completely convincing as a grand piano tuner suffering from a hearing disorder, hyperacusis, allergic to loud noises. This, however, is seen as a superpower by some unscrupulous types, which leads him to a safe-cracking job. I loved Dustin Hoffman, says Chad, and Tova Feldshoes, roles. Tova Feldschuss, did I get that right? I don't know who that is. As Leo's mentors and surrogate parents. Havana Rose Liu plays an aspiring classical composer who catches Leo's eye, but sadly the safe cracking stuff gets in the way of their budding relationship. There's also a nice out-of-character cameo from former action film stalwart Jean Reno, or Jean Reno, if you like. Former action? I don't know that I'd go that far to say former. He still cranks them out. There are a good few movies that have come out recently where he's kicking ass and chewing bubblegum, and he's all out of gum. It's a fairly predictable plot, but very well acted by all. Thanks, Chad. That sounds pretty darn good. I do like Dustin Hoffman. I haven't seen him in a while. But yeah, sounds interesting. What is that, a cinema film or?
No, it's a series, isn't it? Oh, no, it's not. It's a film. I think we did this in Coming Soon, didn't we? It does ring a big bell for me. And
no, not for me.
No? Okay. It's got all sorts of awards. It is a film. It's 2025 film. It's got all sorts of European awards by the looks of it. And it sounds like it's quite interesting. But yeah, Dustin Hoffman does pop up now and again in strange places. Maybe he's not got a big role in this, just a leaf in and out one.
Well, anyway. I wouldn't be going spreading rumours that he pops up in strange places. But yes, it's in theatres now, so it might be worth checking out. Right.
Okay. And lastly, in our feedback section, Adrian Brain is up with Disclosure Day. Now, we did do this in Coming Soon, didn't we? I think.
Yes. Yeah. No, actually, we didn't. Because I thought it was coming out next summer. That's all I didn't. I just thought it was a bit early for trailers.
Right, okay. Well, maybe he's been to the cinema to see it then. But Spielberg's latest addition to the sci-fi genre he once owned, says Adrian, it could easily be considered Close Encounters of the Third Kind Part 2, though it is nowhere near as accomplished as his earlier classic. In fact, in places, it's a real mess. But there are some redeeming features. If you have seen the trailer, you essentially know the plot. Oh, it's one of those. Imagine a bunch of episodes of The X-Files cut up and reassembled, and you essentially have the tone, style, and substance of this film. The first redeeming feature is the brilliant casting. Emily Blunt, ooh, nice. Josh O'Connor, Colin Firth, and Colman Domingo. They're the leads, and each of them are superb. Even actors in the supporting roles shine, says Adrian. Spielberg certainly knows how to get actors to perform at their best. He also knows how to direct thrilling action set pieces. There's one outstanding piece that recalls his Raiders of the Lost Ark heyday. Sadly, though, there is a lot of this happened, then that happened, presented without his usual storytelling flair. Plot holes and implausibility also get in the way of enjoying the proceedings. I did enjoy the main themes of the film, however. Empathy is the superpower, religion is not belief, religion is not belief in an external entity, but belief in humanity. Tongue twister, that is. Even if they were hammered home rather obviously. All in all, he concludes, far from a classic, but just about enough going on to be worth a watch. Yeah, so thank you, Adrian. And perhaps we should put that, if we haven't done that in Coming Soon, perhaps we should.
Yeah, it's in cinemas at the moment, and I think getting you to the cinema might be tough. It's a bit of an odd one, this, and I have to say I hold my hands up by thinking that, you know, they'd started the ad campaign a year early, but it turns out that was the ad campaign, and I was a bit kind of taken aback. But then I started to see some rather negative reviews flowing for it, and I thought perhaps it's not as good as they said, or it's not as strong as they said, and I'd actually talked less about it being a new Spielberg film and more about it just being a big film. But they're now pushing, as of like today, I think I saw a headline, or maybe yesterday, to say that this is Spielberg's biggest grossing non-sequel since Jurassic Park, which I think is quite important. But they're selling it as that, as opposed to, you know, the new must-see film. It's this is making loads of money. Everyone's going to see it, so you should see it too.
Fair enough.
So, but I'll reserve judgment until I watch it, and I do look forward to it. It does look quite interesting, and I wish they'd called it Night Skies. So that would have been a nice nod to sequels of old.
Yeah. Right, okay then. Well, that's the feedback. Thank you very much for that. Let's jump into fandom focus. It was your turn after Benny Hill last time to pick something you're a fan of. What's it going to be?
Well, it's going to be zombies, because I do love zombies. I love zombie movies. And I was trying to think what was my first zombie movie. And I'm actually going to dare to say that it was Dawn of the Dead. Because I can't remember watching one before that. And it was on Channel 4 around about 1991. And I remember watching it and going into school the next day and talking about it with my friends as something amazing. and those that hadn't seen it were really quite envious. And it was a scenario that I wasn't quite aware of, but I became aware of. And it opened up this whole fantasy in my mind about how wonderful it would be for the world to be devoid of anyone else. Obviously, there would be zombies, but they're kind of a slow-moving shuffle. And in the film, there's lots of them, so there's an always impending threat. But it just made me kind of dream about the whole idea of, as a schoolboy, I'd be able to go to the swimming pool and enjoy the swimming pool without anyone else there. I'd be able to go to the shopping centre and go and just get any game, any DVD or video, and watch it without anyone, interfering. I'd be able to just go anywhere I wanted. And I do actually remember at the time talking to one of my friends or thereafter thinking, where would be the ultimate place to go? And we decided Vatican City would be immense. Just sneaking in, or not, you don't even have to sneak. Going into Vatican City would be fantastic in that kind of post-apocalyptic last man on earth, Omega Man type thing. But Dawn of the Dead really excited me about zombie films, and I watched Night of the Living Dead quite soon after that, and Return of the Living Dead soon after that, and those three films just cemented zombies for me. They are three titans of the genre, and therein it was just hit or miss following that. For every good film I managed to encounter, there was a bad film, and I remember Zombie Flesh Eaters being one of the greats, and then The Dead Next Door being another of the greats when I was starting to get into Bruce Campbell movies. And then more recently, they're still knocking out the bangers with like the Shaun of the Dead. Train to Busan is a particularly notable one. What was it? One Cut of the Dead, I think, is it Indian, or it's from that area? I apologize if it's not Indian, but it's from the Middle East, and it's a wonderful zombie movie. I think for every good movie, we now have, 20 or 30 bad movies. And that has actually sort of always been the way, right back to after Dawn of the Dead came out. The Italians started forking them out into the cinemas, and every country was having a go because it was cheap to be able to make a zombie movie. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a good movie. You've got to have excitement and thrills. And Romero, who directed Dawn of the Dead, had satire in there and had a point to make, about commerce and things like that, and various different things. It wasn't just about zombies attacking people. There was more to it. There was an extra layer in there, whereas so many of the other sort of knockoffs and cash-ins were really just about tits and zombies eating people's faces, and it became a bit of a calling card for many, where they would rely on the gore and the makeup effects, and that could make a film stand out from the rest if it had good gore. Like Tom Savini would move from one film to another film, and it would be only notable because the gore effects were done by Tom Savini. It could be absolute garbage, but Tom Savini did the makeup effect, so it's got something going for it. But I wanted to throw out one film that I recommend to people that I think is a wee bit of a it's not a cut above the rest. It's just a little bit different, and I feel that it's so very well realized. And that's a film from 2012 called The Battery, or The Battery, if you like. And it's a little zombie movie about two guys. And I always felt, when I first watched it, I always felt there was a wee bit of tension between the two of them, and things were going to go really bad. One of them's a bit of a badass, the other one's a bit of a wimp. And the two of them have to sort of navigate through the zombie apocalypse. But it bites off a wee bit more than your typical zombie movie, where it has almost real characters or things that people would actually do. Like, you can turn your ears for a minute because this is a wee bit graphic what I'm going to discuss here, but there's a moment where one of them is in the back of the car and he hasn't seen a woman in a long time, and the car is being attacked by a zombie with large knockers and a ripped shirt, and they keep pressing up against the window, and he manages to get off on that, which it's that kind of little detail that makes you go, you know, this is a wee bit different. And they go looking for an ex-girlfriend, and he goes and reads her diary, and it's like, that's something that might happen in post-apocalyptic, as opposed to, you know, military guys going and shooting zombies and trying to find some sort of cure or whatever. Or, you know, the plot is just two guys surviving the zombie apocalypse together. It's just a bit different, and I liked it for that, and I recommend it. It's not fabulous, but it's worth checking out if you get a chance. Ted, are you into your zombie schlock?
Yeah, we too kind of visit zombie territory now and then on the show, as regular listeners will know, and we cover these films. Dawn of the Dead, I agree. I think that was my first zombie film as well. But I saw it in the cinema when it came out, either in 78 or 79 or 80, I can't remember, but the first time I can remember, it was a double bill with, what was it, double bill with, I can't remember
double
now.
Double bill? It's yeah, long enough yeah. as it is without having to pack on another movie.
They used to have, in my day, you always had two films, regardless of how long it was.
Oh, you get a short, like Daffy Duck or Flash Gordon versus people, the news, and then the film.
No, you get two proper films usually. But yeah, I do grant you, if a film is long enough, you probably didn't. But usually the usual thing was to get a main feature and a B movie chucked in. Anyway, the point is that I went to the cinema to see that, and it was all the talk at school or wherever I was. I think I was at school still, yeah. And everyone was all over it, and we were talking about it, and everyone was trying to watch it and watching it, and it just blew everyone away. Really, really good. So that was my first introduction to zombie films. And then, yeah, the other ones that you mentioned, some of them I haven't seen, so I'll add to my watch list. Train to Busan I've seen, and we've got a remake of that coming up. I think it's an American remake, and I can't remember what it's called now. I think it's already out. It's called, what's it called? I'll try and remember while I carry on. But the I think I might have it.
I'll look it up. You carry on.
Okay. So yeah, zombie films have always been really nifty and great fun and escapism. And yeah, some of them are crap, but the good ones are really good, and the good ones get you on the edge of your seat as well. So really, really good fun. And I'm always drawn to them. I'm same as you, I think. If we're going to choose genres, then that will be one of the ones that I would like to have high on my list. Here it is, The Last Train to New York.
Well, yeah, I just noticed that. That's one of the worst titles. I hope it's got something better coming up. But if you're on IMDb, take a wee scroll down and have a look at More Like It, because there's Plane to Busan.
Right.
It's a Hindi knockoff. Okay.
Oh yeah, Train to Busan.
Looks very like it indeed.
Train to Busan.
It was such a simple but well-made Korean action horror film that it rocked, absolutely rocked. Mm-hmm. And it didn't. It had a sequel that wasn't. I don't think I managed to watch all of the sequel. I think I got a bit bored. And there was an animated spin-off as well, if memory serves. Yes, there was Train to Busan Peninsula.
Yes, that's right.
I think I've seen that.
Right. They like it, though. The South Koreans love all that. Good for them.
Yeah, there's another big zombie movie coming up called Rampage or something. I can't remember. I'm not going to try. Never mind. Carry on.
Anyway, yeah, good fandom focus that appeals to us both, because I really like zombie films and I'm drawn to them, and TV shows as well, you know, like and some of them are more zombified than others, you know, like The Last of Us. The Last of Us was just brilliant, but the zombie bit of it felt very secondary to the storyline. It was just a kind of side thing going on, and when it came along, it was just great. But because it wasn't the main thrust of the story, it made it even more special, I think. So anyway, yeah, love it, and I'm with you on that.
Well, that's always the problem with zombie shows, and there's been a good amount of zombie shows over the years as well, and they usually start out quite strong whenever they establish the main crux of it. Like, The Walking Dead was fantastic. The first two seasons of that, I think, were very good, maybe even the third, where they got to the prison. But I checked out after the fifth, maybe the sixth, because it was just turning into a drama, you know, with the domestic drama of the people and affairs and romances. Yeah. And then they lose someone and they become all moody, and then they get over that, and then they lose someone else and get all moody. And mm-hmm. I think that's the ongoing thing with zombie shows, because they realize there's not too much you can do with zombies other than kill someone and then people be moody, and then move on to the next one, then have them killed. Moody. There was Z Nation, was another popular one as well that seems to have fallen away. And then was it Black Zombies or Black Rain Zombie? That's another one I have queued up, but I haven't started yet. I've heard good reports about, and it only had two seasons and then it got cancelled. But there's a few zombie shows.
I'm with you. Right, okay. Well, thanks for that. Good fandom focus for both of us, that was. Right, let's get to private screening. And you chucked something at me that I needed two bites at the cherry for.
And I had two bites at the cherry too. This is a movie that I've known about for years. I bought it on the basis of its reputation as being an utterly fantastic art house horror thriller that is French, I believe, it's called Irreversible. It stars Monica Bellucci, Vincent Cassel, Albert Dupontel, and it's directed by Gaspar Noé. And it is an entire assault on all of your senses throughout. And I am interested in your journey with it, Ted, before I start into mine. Do tell.
Well, I gave up on it after 25 minutes. I started watching it and I thought to myself, this is just shit. And I sent you a message and I said to you, I'm just like, I don't get this. It had this awful, droning, irritating, buzzy music. But it wasn't even music. It was just like sound going on, which was just annoying my ears completely. And there was this ludicrous handheld camera thing going on, which was not just your usual handheld camera, but the camera person was going round in circles and upside down, and just I get that they were in a Parisian gay club or whatever it was, and so they were trying to demonstrate that people were high and that's what they were seeing and blah blah blah. I mean, I get all the reasoning why behind it and all the rest, but it was just making me feel sick. And with all the red lights in near darkness. And I thought, what a load of bollocks this is. And I was about to score, give it a zero. And then you said to me, give it another try. I said, right, okay, I'll start again at 25 minutes. And then after about an hour, we get to the scene, which presumably it's most famous for, which is that there's a rape scene in this Parisian underground walkway. And this rape scene is just so incredibly, dare I say, well done, well acted. And it goes on for about 12 minutes all in all. And it's brutal and it's graphic and it's violent and it's foul and it's horrible and it's nasty. But the two actors, who you'll tell us who they are in a minute, are they've just done it incredibly well, and they stay with it. And it looks to me like it's all been done in one shot as well. And it's just gobsmacking when you see that. I've never seen such a incredible scene like that in any other film. Even, you know, real kind of snuff type movie films, or pretend snuff movie films, and they've just made that incredibly well. Or, you know, as I say, well produced, well acted, nasty and horrible as it all is. But there's also a much nicer erotic consensual sex scene later on, which is worth a look.
It's horrible. But Vincent Cassell's bottom? No.
And there's plenty of, but yeah, throughout there's plenty of nudity, really. And I was going to give it zero, and I still think that it's there's good acting, and it's a brave attempt, I think, at art house. But for me, it just wasn't a film for me. I was really interested to see that rape scene, which is presumably, as I say, what it's all about. But I'm not going to score it. I'll give it five because that scene was done so well and the acting was just brilliant. But that's about it, because the rest of it was just not my kind of film. How did you get on with it?
Well, this was the first time I'd seen it. However, as I said, I bought it based on its reputation, and I knew it was a nasty film, but I didn't know in what way. I wasn't aware of the rape scene. I just thought perhaps it was a bit like Possession from 1981. You know, the Sam Neill horror film. I can't remember who directed it off the top of my head because it just popped in there. But yeah, it's an unconventional approach to storytelling, because it walks its way back through the events of the film. So you start at the end with the conclusion, if you can call it that, and it works its way back to the start of the story, which, you know, it's an assault on you, because it's a violent, bloody mess at the start, I didn't feel it was an art film, as more of an assault on your senses. The wild cameras, I think it's quite interesting that you were feeling that was more something to do with the people being high and all that. And that I hadn't clocked that. I was feeling more it was like a fly on the wall documentary, or a fly on the wall approach, where the fly would be buzzing about and things like that, and you get to see a glimpse of this and a glimpse of that as it sort of works its way through, and it follows Cassell on his mission to seek his revenge. But it takes a long time for this film to settle to any state that becomes a bit more comfortable to watch, because you have to get through that sequence with Monica Bellucci and Joe Prestia in the subway, and that is really, really hard to watch. And I'll be entirely honest with you, I did fast forward through it because it was getting more and more uncomfortable, and I just can't take that anymore. I'm honest about it. So I flicked forward, and I couldn't tell you how long it was. I watched the aftermath of it, but as it you know, I think it thrives on making the audience uncomfortable. However, that comes to an end, and we get the whole sort of the pre-story, I suppose would be the best way to describe it, as it cleans up. And it somewhat ends on a happy ending, to be honest. It's a weird thing. But the crucial thing about it, because I, as you double-dipped it, I double-dipped it as well, because the Blu-ray comes with the film in the straight cut and the original cut. And the straight cut is the film in the other direction, where it starts at the end and works its way back. And I enjoyed it a great deal more. I guess I was kind of more prepared for what to expect. And it built up to it, as opposed to throwing shit at you and expecting you just to swim. you're building up. And I think it was a much better narrative. They didn't make that cut until a good few years later, whenever it was being released on DVD or something like that, they put it out. But it kind of explains things more, and maybe it's because it's more traditional narrative, it becomes a bit more acceptable, and you kind of enjoy the rolling camera as it appears toward the end, because things go crazier and wilder as things get more and more uncomfortable. And I much prefer it in that direction. I'm not saying it's better. I just preferred it. But had I watched them the other way round to start with, I do wonder which way or what my feeling would have been. It's kind of like Ted, you always wonder what people who watch Better Call Saul before Breaking Bad make of it. Is it that kind of, does it change everything? Is it a totally different approach? But yes, I'm glad to have watched it. I will never watch it again, which is going to be devastating for Powerhouse, I think it was, or Indicator, whoever put it out on Blu-ray. I suppose they've sold it to me, but I won't be buying it in 4K, that's for sure. I'm happy enough with that Blu-ray sitting over there, but I've done it now, and it's one of those films that, you know, I've been there, I've experienced it, and that's enough for me. You're okay, and I've realized what a big wuss I am. And I know, Ted, you've probably watched over that rape sequence a few times and was like, really enjoyed it. But actually, of it, looking at the cast list, I never quite understood what the opening scene and in the other version the very final scene of the film were about, with the old man sitting on a bed naked, or pretty much naked, talking to the other fella, and they don't have any drink and they don't have any cigarettes left. And I never quite understood what that had to do with the film. Maybe someone else can explain, but I should watch a YouTube review or something like that to see if someone explains what it is. But hats off to Gaspar for getting Monica Bellucci in this. I mean, when you see her in that white satin dress, you know, a jaw hits the floor. She is utterly stunning. And you're full of rage whenever things happen to her as the film progresses, and you can't believe that would happen. You know, I know they're making the statement about her being high society and you know, the gutter snipes, if you like, coming in and they're entering into each other's world and what happens and the hatred that the tapeworm Latenia has for Monica Bellucci's character of Alex, because she's gone through life as being beautiful and having everything, whereas life has been a struggle for him, for everything he receives. And he himself, I think, is homosexual, and he attacks her from behind, and the everything that happens there is just brutal and hard. It's just unrelenting that way. I really want to know what that start bit or end bit, depending on which way you watch it, has to do with it, because it's now making me wonder, is that one of the characters in later years, or was he telling the story or something? I'm intrigued. Need to check that out. So yeah, I did take my hat off to it. I I don't know how to score this. I really haven't. I haven't given it any thought on what I would give it out of 15. You've given it...
I've given it 5 for the acting and the brilliant in that scene. It, as I say, it's not really my kind of film, but that scene is just amazing to watch, as brutal and uncomfortable as it is. It's just been done so well. So I'm going to give it 5 for the acting and the production of that bit of the film. The rest of it, I just didn't like at all.
Yeah. See, I respect it entirely for everything that it does, and I know that it's not a film to enjoy. You can't sit down like Star Wars and just watch it of an evening. You have to have a reason to watch this, and I can imagine people in the cinema vomiting as the film opens, and it would just clear the cinema out. I can't imagine there were too many seats after the first 20 minutes, you know, with... As you ended up turning it off, imagine you were sitting in an IMAX cinema with that going on.
Yeah.
Oh man, that would be harsh. But I respect it for everything that it's doing, and I was compelled by it, and I needed to know what was happening. And I think it was a very well made film. It was daring. It was incredibly well performed, and Bellucci is sensational. Vincent Cassel is absolutely fantastic too. He needs to keep his clothes on. But I'm going to give it 9. No, in fact, I'm going to give it 10 because of that white satin dress. Yeah, 10.
Okay, so that gives it 15 then, and that puts it into the company of The Grey Man, The Last Showgirl, which I scored 0, Slumberland, Warriors of Future. I don't even remember that. Hunter. That kind of territory anyway.
Hunter, so, that was the TV show, wasn't it? Yeah, was it? Yeah, we watched the pilot episode of Hunter.
Right. Anyway, so it's about a third of the way up our table, but not because it's not been well made. It's just the subject matter and what it was about. And if we were a couple of art house critics' experience, we would probably score it higher. We'd say we would find stuff in it that was just, you know, I'm sure it's won lots of awards and everything, but we're a couple of deviants.
Are we? Speak for yourself there. Yeah.
But it was a good exercise, so good choice. And very interesting. I would never have watched it if we'd not done it. So there you go. Right. My turn to pick one for next time. And I pulled one out of a bin somewhere from 1967 called In Cold Blood. Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. Two ex-cons murder a family in a robbery attempt before going on the run from the authorities, who try to piece together the details of the murder in an attempt to track down the killers. Directed by Richard Brooks, and it stars Robert Blake, Scott Wilson, and John Forsythe. And it just looked like an interesting film. I'd never heard of it, never seen it. I just stumbled into it, and I thought, I'll put a link into the wiki data on the whole thing as well, which is quite interesting. But I think we should probably try and both watch that for the next show, unless you already have.
Oh, I've seen it, but I'm more than happy to watch it again. I can even score it now, okay. If you want.
Right.
But yes, after you do that, you can start revisiting the story about Robert Blake.
Okay. I shall make a note of that then. So anyway, Truman Capote's In Cold Blood. And it sounds as though I should jolly well know all about it, but I didn't. And so
I think there's a good reason why it's not considered the classic now that it should be. And that's because of Blake.
Okay. Right. Okay.
No, it's fine.
More for me to explore. So we'll see. Right. For the meantime, though, let's move on to themed treats. And it was your turn to choose a theme.
Yes. What did I choose? I can't remember because we're a week late. Arid climates. Deserty films. Films where it's hot and sweaty. I figured that might be quite interesting because we did something like that before, didn't we?
Maybe. We did wet climates, didn't we?
Maybe, yes. Or we did Mars and it's dusty.
Oh, hang on a minute. We've got a list of what we did. It was trains. How is that?
Ah, of course, yeah.
Yeah, there's no link there at all. A load of rubbish. No. Anyway, carry on.
Maybe it was something we were talking about in the last show. Yeah.
Well,
I've gone with a couple of very arid films. You mentioned at the end of the last podcast a very obvious film that we've discussed before in Ice Cold and Alex. So I decided to try to work around that and not go with that because we've discussed it before. So I have picked out The Flight of the Phoenix. And I'm going to say both versions because they're both very hot and sweaty. One more so than the other. One of them is very arid and dry. The other one is hot and sweaty with biceps and pectorals covered in sweat, and I'll let you work out which one that is. But the first one is with James Stewart, Richard Attenborough, Peter Finch, and Hardy Kruger. Ernst Borgnine's in there, if memory serves. And it's an absolutely fantastic war set film. It's not a war film, but it's a war set film about a plane that crashes in the Sahara, and they have to try to survive and engineer a way out, and it's just a character piece about the characters that are there, and a tale of survival, and it's absolutely rock solid, superb, in every way. And I would go as far to say that the remake is a very decent remake. It's not a patch on the original, but it's a very entertaining, big budget, glossy, blockbuster film that will entertain anyone who sits down to watch it. And if you want more of the original, then you can get this. Have you seen these two?
Yes, I have, both of them. I think I probably did a feature on them years ago on the podcast because I challenged myself to watch both of them and compare them. But it was the dim and distant past. I do remember James Stewart being, you know, just the bee's knees, but then he usually is, isn't he? I really enjoyed the original. And yeah, like you, the remake was not a patch and not as good, but it had its own charm. It was like like remakes often are, I think. But it's perfectly watchable and still a good thriller, yeah. And dry, 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 you're right.
Yes. Well, to complement that, and along a similar theme, I suppose, and the same setup, is Sahara. No, not the one with McConaughey and not the one with Brooke Shields. I think there's another Sahara as well, with Leslie Ann Downe, maybe, or the Sphinx. No, that's Sphinx. Sahara from 1943, starring Humphrey Bogart. And it's another exceptional war film. But I actually wanted to it doesn't need an introduction because it's a really awesome war film that it's an absolute classic. It's not as good as the big classics, but it is a very good film. But I wanted to actually highlight that in 1995 there was a made for TV remake starring James Belushi called Sahara, and it's actually quite difficult to get a hold of. I don't think it's been released fully on DVD or Blu-ray, but the poster on IMDb actually has a big blue HD across the top of it, so it must be released somewhere. But I caught this years ago on Sky, I think it was, and it rocked. It was really good. I was a bit shocked that this was just a TV movie, and it's got James Belushi taking on the boogie role of Joe Gunn. And the action is exciting. It's sweaty. It's tense. It's dusty. It's uncomfortable. It's a really, really good retelling, and it's virtually unheard of. Well, I'm not going to say virtually unheard of, but it'll take you a while to track it down if you want to try and find it. But it's absolutely worth it, and it's very family friendly as well, and it makes for a really good matinee if you're sitting down on a Saturday afternoon wanting something to watch in the winter, which is when we should be doing this. But yeah, worth checking out if you're into that sort of thing. Ted, have you seen either of these?
No, I haven't. And I'm very interested in the 1943 version, more so than the other one, I think.
Despite singing its praises.
Yeah. I what's not to like with Bogey in the lead, I suppose. But I just wasn't aware of it. Well, you say it's a World War II story. Presumably it's like a kind of Desert Rat type film, is it?
It is, yeah.
Yeah, so
and it was made in the middle of the war as well, or well, toward the end of the war, I suppose, of the Second World War. So it was one of those kind of patriotical, enthusiastic war films that got the troops going. You know, it's one of those.
I usually know about these films, but I don't know this one, so I'm definitely going to track that down. The other one doesn't seem so attractive to me, but the way that you're enthusing about it, perhaps it is. And I should make this a double bill at my cinema in 1979.
It's a genuine surprise. I'm a fan of Belushi, so perhaps I'm a wee bit biased that way. But I think anyone who watches it will ultimately enjoy it.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with it. He's good. The last one, I think, is the ultimate desert movie, and it's Mad Max 2. Or the Road Warrior, as they like to call it, in America land. And I think this is just one of the best action movies all round. It's one of my top 10 easily. And it's just dry and uncomfortable and dirty, dusty, sandy, all that kind of stuff throughout it. And I can't fault this movie at all. Everything in this movie just works. It is constantly entertaining. It's got a little bit of humor, a little bit of drama. It's got Mel Gibson at his height. 2 days ago, I saw a rig that got all that tanker. And I love everything about this film. The gyro captain, the little blonde lady who passed away soon after. What was her name? Archie Whiteley. She passed away strangely afterward. Virginia Hay is the warrior woman who, when I was on Facebook all those years ago, she sent me a message once. Which you got Vernon Wells and the Humongous and things. Oh, I can't talk about this film enough. I love it. It's one of those sequels that's better than the original. It's the best of the franchise, bar none. I know some people will say Mad Max Fury Road is better than this, but it's not. No, it's not. Road Warrior, Mad Max 2, is possibly the best sequel ever made, aside from Evil Dead 2 and The Empire Strikes Back. And Star Trek 2.
And this other list of 20. Part 2. Yes. I saw this in the cinema again, but I haven't seen it since 1981, and I can't remember a thing about it, frankly. These Mad Max films, all of them, as they came out, I went to the cinema and watched them, and I never watched them again. And I think I've got the DVDs in my collection, and I've probably never watched them. They've probably still got the cellophane on them. So perhaps now that you've said that two is better than one, I thought you were going to say that one was the best. So now you've said two is better than one, perhaps I should go back and at least watch the first two again and see if I agree with you.
No, go do a marathon. Start in the morning, work your way right up to Furiosa. You'll be ready for bed by then.
Yeah.
And then play the game. Yeah.
So there was a good little collection there. I decided to watch one that I'd not seen before and was relatively recent. 2023, The Dead Don't Hurt, which is basically a Western. I mean, an arid climate. Any Western could be chosen, really, couldn't it?
True.
Well, apart from the ones that are set in the snow, like the Tarantino's, The Hateful Eight. That's a Western. Set in the snow.
But the snow isn't arid. I suppose you can't drink snow. People do die of thirst in the snow, don't they?
So anyway, but mostly any Western will do. This Western is one that has been directed and written and even scored by Viggo Mortensen. And it's a very mellow, character-driven film set in the 1860s. It's got a little bit of a feel of Little House on the Prairie about it, but it's good quality, I think. And the absolute star of the show is Vicky Cripes as Vivian. It is, in many ways, a simple love story about the two of them. They meet in San Francisco. She's a fiercely independent French-Canadian flower seller. And Olsen, who's the Mortensen character, is a Danish immigrant. He's a carpenter. She's trying to break away from a really crappy relationship she's in. Someone's pursuing her and she doesn't like him because he's such a twit. And so Vivian and Olsen run away together into the remote, barren and dry and arid landscape to his cabin, which is near this town called Elk Flats. We follow the story of Vivian mostly because the timeline jumps around quite a lot. And it actually starts with Vivian on her deathbed. And then it flashes back to show us the rest of the kind of growing relationship and what happened before that and how they met in, as I say, San Francisco. And it tells the story of Olsen impulsively joining the Union Army to fight the Civil War, Vivian being left to fend for herself. She managed to do that, but she's got to fend off this local sociopath. Weston Jeffries, the character's name is, and he is just giving her a hard time the whole time he's away. Turns out that Mortensen's character Olsen is away in the end for about 4 or 5 years, and you know she's just there the whole time, and we kind of follow her life while she's making do. She goes and gets a job in the town's bar, the saloon, and you know it makes do, and then he comes back, and then it's a little bit kind of Little House on the Prairie-ish, but there is it's beautifully shot, done really really well, bit of a one man production from Mortensen, but he's also in it for you know most of it. But fortunately, he's handed over the kind of starring role to Vicky Cripes. And Vicky Cripes really steals it. She's such a good actor. And I was trying to work out where I knew her from. Do you know Vicky Cripes? I got a feeling I should know her from something quite recently. And I'm looking it up now as we go and trying to work. Oh, yeah, I know what it was. It was Old, that Night Shyamalan or whatever he's called film. And I remember
Night Shyamalan.
That's a chappy, and a few other films as well. So anyway, I'll link to my little review of that because that was really, really good film. And I suggest that you and your your wife would like it. I would guess because it is quite mellow.
I do have this on my watch list because Mortensen directed it and wrote it as well. Yeah, I remember it coming out. Yeah.
Okay. And the other one I was going to highlight was Gold, which we spoke about on the show before, which is this thriller set in the Australian outback, where these two guys are going on this long drive across, you know, the middle of the desert. And they've got this beaten up old truck and it's broken and it breaks down. And one of them decide. Well, they find this nugget of gold under the earth, but they just happen to find it, and it's too big for them to dig it out. So one of them decides that he's going to go off to walk to a town and bring back an excavator, and the other one stays behind to kind of guard the treasure. So most of the film actually is in watching the guy that stays behind. His water runs out and there's sandstorms and there's a huge, the whole kind of dry, battered, sun-scorched thing. It's just amazing to watch. You know, and when he gets really, really low, and the flies come in and they try to, you know, it looks like he's going to snuff it any minute, with the dry, the arid climate taking its toll. So it's a real slow burn. I won't tell you what happens at the end of it, dear listener, but there are some twists and turns later on. But the whole thing has got minimal dialogue, but it's all about that isolation and dehydration. Very, very ice cold in Alex in some ways, but you're out there with him the whole time. Do you remember it now?
I remember it, absolutely, thinking the plot was pretty fantastic, but I can remember nothing about the film.
Yeah. Perhaps you haven't seen it.
No, I'm pretty sure I have. I'm having a look at some images just for the poster cover, or the podcast poster cover. And I remember it. I remember Zac Efron's face, but maybe it's just off in the trailer. Why didn't I watch this? It sounds good. Yes, I'll watch this.
Yeah, it is good. It's a good film. It's very well done. And then a quick mention, going back to World War II films, The Bridge on the River Kwai, which is horribly, horribly arid and dry, as we know. We've spoken about that before. And another one we've spoken about before, talking about Australia, is Walkabout, the 1971 film with Jenny Agutter. And yeah, that was a big favourite of Alan's as well. We've covered that before. And that, yeah, that gives the whole feeling of really, really dry atmosphere. The River Kwai particularly comes home, where Alex Guinness is in the cooler, or whatever they call it, the sandbox. What do they call it? I think it's a cooler, isn't it?
It's cooler, yeah.
Well, yeah.
Maybe.
And you know, when he's got to survive in this box, and that's when it really feels hot and horrible. Anyway, yeah. So that was my approach on the theme for this time.
Yeah.
So we'll put the links in the show notes to all of that, and you can have a look.
Good choice. Good choices. Mm-hmm.
And my turn to pick the theme for next show, and I decided to choose hospitals, and I've no idea why. It just came into my head, and I thought, oh yeah, well, hospitals, that'd be interesting. Lots of things on the telly and in film and cinema is about hospitals, so we'll probably get lots of interesting choices. So there you go.
I'll have to just quickly check, because I watched Article 99 recently, and I reviewed it, and I can't remember if I've published it yet or if it's in the queue, because I've got quite an extensive queue. I think it's in the queue. I don't think it's gone out yet.
What's Article 99?
Well, then you don't know. It's a hospital MASH type movie.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, we'll come to that on the next show. So hospitals it is. Now to the main feature. And my first choice of the main feature is a film I watched, which you'll probably really enjoy. It's a bonkers survival thriller called They Will Kill You. And it follows Asia Reeves as Zazie Beetz, who goes undercover as a servant in a historic Manhattan block of flats to rescue her sister, Maria. Instead, she finds a cult of robe-wearing, pig-masked elites led by an unhinged Patricia Arquette. Patricia Arquette is so funny and so good in this. She's just nasty and plays her role beautifully. She's not in it a huge amount, but when she is, she's really good. So they lock down the building to sacrifice Asia to win their immortality. So they've done this kind of deal with the devil kind of thing. Little do they know, Asia can fight, though, because she's been in prison. Armed with swords and shotguns, she embarks on a relentless Kill Bill-style massacre as she works her way up through the building to try and escape with her sister. So, yeah, there's this demonic ledger. These wealthy people have bought into, and the deal is that they, if they can find enough people to sacrifice for the demon, then they can get they can get eternal life, essentially. And if they get killed, then they instantly regenerate. And so you can imagine that the body horror stuff going on in here is really extreme. And it's quite comic at times. You get people just dying, having their heads lopped off, and suddenly the head comes back and they put it back on and they're alive again. It's just bonkers. It's mad. It does have a striking, vivid look. I mean, think about Wes Anderson stuff, I suppose, for colours. And the building reminds me of the Overlook Hotel, actually, from The Shining, which is really funny. And Guesthouse Paradiso, which I'm not even sure if you've seen yet. That's what? The Aid and Rick film. Oh, right. I thought when we last talked about it, you were ashamedly admitting you hadn't seen it. Right, okay.
No, I said I didn't like it.
Oh, right, okay, that was it.
I've seen it many times.
So Guesthouse Paradiso has got passageways and stuff behind the walls going on. It's really, really funny. And so this building has got some of that stuff going on as well. The cinematography is great. The CGI is really well done. And everyone's got tongue in cheek, and it's a rip roaring. The finale is really funny because there's an animated severed pig's head that just steals the show. Really funny, breathless. I put in my notes: visually stunning and delightfully mad. Really, really good. They Will Kill You, 2026 film, and yeah, go and watch it. It's great fun. You got to be in the right mood, obviously. Friday night, couple of beers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it does sound very good. I don't think my wife's going to like it. It looks a bit too visceral and bloody for her. But that sounds good. Yeah, cool. Well, I went back to the 1980s and I actually watched with my son.
What a surprise!
a little classic. It was about time that he, at the age of 13, experienced The Fog. The Carpenter's classic, because The Fog isn't a gory movie. It doesn't have nudity or anything that's particularly bad. I think it needs to be reclassed from, I think it's an 18, but I think it needs to go down to about a 12, because it's genuinely harmless. And it's a classic. It's a mood classic. Whenever you actually sit down and try to sort of analyze the story and the plot and the beats, the film, it's a bit messy. And I know a lot of people are going to go, how dare you say that about The Fog? But it is. The storyline is a bit messy, and it all just kind of comes together because it has to come together at the end. And the whole point of it is a bit kind of, well, let's find out what's happening here. And then whenever they find out what's happening, they just resolve it and everything goes back to normal. It's actually kind of disappointing whenever you boil it down to the nuts and bolts of the film. But it's all about what Carpenter does and his use of special effects and low budget and the performances of the lead characters. You've got Janet Leigh, Adrian Barbeau, Jamie Lee Curtis, Tom Atkins, Hal Holbrook. And it's just mind-boggling how great this film all comes together. We were all totally entranced watching the new, I think it's Studio Canal, did a 4K of it recently, and you get to see the wisps of the fog coming through and the glow of the eyes and the fog and things. And it made me think of what it must have been like. Ted, I'm sure, Jack, back in 1980, you were in the cinema hiding behind the sofa. Or not the sofa, that'd be a bit weird. Don't take a sofa to the cinema, that's silly. You're not going to get it in through the door particularly well. And you'll probably get popcorn stuck down the back of it. Yeah. But if you're in the rows of the cinema rows, hiding down behind those, you'll... You were probably terrified by it, were you?
I'm afraid I've got the same tale to tell you that I had with Mad Max. I went to the cinema to watch this, absolutely, and I can't remember a thing about it, which it maybe not be surprising, because 1980 is, how many years ago is that? 45 years ago or something? And I I honestly can't remember anything about The Fog, but I do remember us all going to watch it and us all again all talking about it and being fired up about it. Obviously, my memory is shot. I'm getting old. I'm getting senile, and I'm going to have to go and watch this again as well.
Well, to be entirely honest, I didn't remember it particularly well, and I haven't seen it in about 10 years, maybe. I don't think I have it on Blu-ray. It must have been since I watched the DVD in the early 2000s. That'll be the last time I saw it, and I didn't remember the majority of it. I think I was a bit kind of taken aback. I was like, oh, Tom Atkins is in this. I don't remember him being in this, but yeah. he was there, and, you know, Tom Atkins is a good staple of horror. And I noticed that it was a bit kind of strange that, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis was in the first two Halloween movies, and then they changed the Halloween movies and made The Season of the Witch, which starred Tom Atkins, and they were together in this. So it was kind of a funny relationship there. But listening to Adrienne Barbeau talk over the radio and things and do her yelling down, going, my son is in the house, I need your help, someone go there, and the only people who go are Tom Atkins and Jamie Lee Curtis. It's just a really peculiar movie, but it's so charming in its limit, because even though John Carpenter had made a couple of films before this, and he was already on the notable directors to watch list. You know, he'd done Dark Star in 1974, Salt and Precinct 13, and then Halloween, which is a huge hit. He followed Halloween up with a TV movie called with Lauren Hutton, Someone's Watching Me, which I didn't get on with. I didn't really like that very much. And then he did Elvis with Kurt Russell, which I can kind of understand why he would do that, you know, being Elvis fans and all that. But it got him together with Kurt Russell, and the two of them would work on a lot of films after that. But The Fog was his first film after that, and it was his first film since Halloween. And it's got a meagre budget. What he manages to achieve with that is fantastic. And he would do Escape from New York after this, and then The Thing, which, you know, were much bigger budgeted films because he had a good few films under his belt to be able to go back and get the money. But where you imagine a lot of filmmakers might struggle with a lower budget, I think he thrives on the lower budget. And the Fog is just an absolute classic for that. I adore it. I wish there was more to it. You know, I wish there was like a unrated cut or an extended cut for you to get your teeth into and to be able to talk about it a bit more, because I think most people listening to this now will have seen The Fog at some stage and just know that it's a good, strong horror film. They might not remember it, how ungraphic it is and how tame it is in comparison to other ones and what a mood piece it is. But yeah, it is a wonderful movie and worth reevaluating by most. It's totally different to The Thing, which is the other end of the spectrum, where it is all body horror and gore to carry forward that way. But give The Thing, The Fog,
I'll
go.
I'll track it down and watch it for a second time in my life.
And well, I remember the remake wasn't too bad either. There was a remake about 2006 or so that did quite well. I don't know.
We did one in Projector Room about these people that were stuck in a supermarket. Okay.
There was a remake of The Fog in 2005. Wow, I wasn't too far off. And I remember quite enjoying that, and it's on Netflix at the moment. But it you know, it's nowhere near the original. But it's still a decent enough remake. It's not as poor as many of them are.
Cool. Okay. I'll put that on my list then to rewatch for the second time in my life. In the meantime, I was watching Fuse. I got a feeling we had this in coming soon.
We did.
Yeah. And this is a slick British crime thriller. So the setup is that these construction workers in London find what looks like an unexploded World War II bomb. Enter an army bomb disposal squad led by Major Will Tranter and this policewoman, Susanna, who's in charge of the police. And she immediately orders a mass evacuation of the whole area. So the whole section of London is empty, apart from this bomb squad and a few coppers. And the what's going on in reality is that there's a group of crooks who are hidden inside a building when this happened, and they've got plans to rob a bank, drill through a wall on the other side of the bank from a building, and drill in and nick all the stuff from there. Being led by this diamond expert, most of it's about diamonds and really, really expensive diamonds. So while the police think that they're managing some World War II bomb crisis, actually what it's really about is these guys that I won't tell you any spoilers, but at the same time, they're drilling this hole through the wall and robbing this bank. It turns out, as we go through the film, that this World War II bomb is actually not really a World War II bomb. It's got a live trigger in it. And by this time, you're kind of working out that the two things are not disassociated. So it doesn't take too much brain power. But eventually the police woman, Susanna, starts to smell a rat. And yeah, eventually it turns into a bit of an action thriller, really. A cat and mouse kind of chase through the streets of London and the sewers. And it's an action adventure story taken to extreme, really. There's a chaotic finale where nobody, it turns out, is quite who they seem, as you might imagine. But it's fast-paced. It's really good fun. It's well directed, it's well put together, and it's a really good thrill ride. And it's only just over an hour and a half to watch, and I think that it's well worth a watch if you're right in the right mood. So it's called Fuse, F-U-Z-E, and it's on, I can't remember what it's on now, it's on streaming at the moment. So have a look.
Yeah, I think this looks quite good. It's Sam Worthington and your man who's one of the high contenders to be Bond from Bullet Train. I can't remember his name. Aaron Taylor Johnson, is it?
Okay.
Potentially. I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, Aaron Taylor Johnson. Yeah, that's what it says here.
And Theo James as well. So it's got a damn good cast. And it's nice to see a British action movie that's kind of up there, rivals that of the American ones that we would get, and they would sort of dominate the cinema. Because we've had a few recently, the one with Daisy Ridley and Clive Owen, I think it was a stab in that direction. So hopefully this is a better stab in that direction, and it might do some business. Yeah,
it's good.
I
enjoyed it.
All right, the next one is 11:14, and it's a little film that I was recommended it by. I was watching Planet CHS on YouTube, and he picked it up on DVD, and I thought, oh, they've got that. And I gave it a watch because I'd never seen it before, and he said it was really good. And I got on quite well. If there's one thing that the 90s did well, it was little indie flicks. This was a decade that they were on the rise, and they were full of all kinds of fun concepts and odd approaches by various directors on their way up, and starring names that once meant something in the decades prior. In this case, we've got Patrick Swayze headlining with a cast of lesser known but some well known big names. I think Barbara Hershey's in there as well. But 11:14, which is based around a time, as in almost 11:15 at night. So technically it's 23:14, just to be 24-hour clock about it. Or it should be 11:14 p.m. But that's Americans for you. Is one of those little indie flicks that did well in my respect. It's got several tales and several characters' paths that intersect at the time 11, 14, one night. And there's a range of different characters, and some intersect with other stories as the story progresses, and it all culminates into a bit of a twist at the end. It's a pretty notable romp in that it takes itself less seriously than you might expect. And it's a well-measured dose of light humour, especially in Patrick Swayze's scenes. But the believable characters fill the story, and the events are worked out in a very believable way. And what's more, the film doesn't go to any lengths to try to have anything more sensational than just a well-thought-out story and well-written dialogue. And it's something I feel that is maybe lacking today, and the 90s did quite well. Hilary Swank leads the cast, and I think Rachel Lee Cook, she's kind of top billed. It takes a while for her to show up in the film, if memory serves. Barbara Hershey is one of the main actresses, although she's not in it very much. I was a bit disappointed. I like Barbara Hershey a great deal, and if you ever watch The Entity, you know, you'll understand why. Colin Hanks is there. I don't know how close this is to like his first film, but it's Tom Hanks' son. Ben Foster is there as well, and Henry Thomas from E.T. He kind of gets the film going. He sort of bookends the film. There's a really solid cast, but there's no real star of the film. All the roles kind of, they add up to similar amounts of screen time. It's one of those ensemble casts where there isn't anyone who is particularly highlighted. I'd say that actually of them all, Ben Foster has the most challenging role in the entire film. Any gentleman who's watching this film will really, really feel compassion toward his character, because what he goes through, any man would hate to have to do. It's hard work, I would imagine. But all the characters are well constructed and really believable. The music is one thing that was a little middling. I can't quite remember exactly what it was, but I know that during Patrick Swayze scenes, it sounds a bit overly comical for what it is, and I feel it was a little bit misjudged. It was the one bit that stood out in the rest of the film that just felt they could have done better there. But, you know, for the most part, I didn't notice any of the music until that particular scene. And it's the only lower quality moment in the entire film. As the film progresses, it's grand. It's a good film. It all concludes very nicely. It all ties itself up well. And I just thought it was a really well-executed little indie film that deserves to see an audience, especially today, because I've checked and it's not out on Blu-ray or 4K. It's quite difficult to get on streaming. I think I looked into it and it's not streaming on any major networks. I feel a bit lucky that I have the DVD, although it is an ex-rental DVD at that. But Ted, you've seen this.
I have, and it turned out that I had the DVD, and I had watched it. I just looked it up on Amazon, and you can buy the DVD for £3.84. And so it looks like that might be used, though. Yeah, that's secondhand. So you could probably get it from places like Music Magpie or something. But it seems that I already had it, and I did watch this film, obviously when I first got the CD from the DVD, whenever that was. I pretty much agree with what you're saying, really. Hilary Swank is really annoying. Tom Hanks is really young. I couldn't believe it. I didn't even recognize him at first. I thought, is that him? Blimey, he's so young here. And yeah, Rachel Lee Cook does, you're right, she does rock up late. And it's an ensemble piece, isn't it? Where, as you say, no one's grabbing the limelight here. The writing is what is the limelight, and they're pulling the strings together across the timeline to kind of make it all stitch up. I think it's trying to be a little bit more too clever than its value, to be honest. It didn't, you know, it felt as though it needed to have a better edge to it. It was all a kind of not obvious, but it was a bit, it just didn't, it felt as though the writing could have just been more interesting and a bit better. But not taking anything away from it, it's you're right, it's an enjoyable little film, an indie film, and I remember watching it. I did flick through it again when I saw that you were going to talk about it today, and yeah, it all came back to me. Feels very 1980s in lots of ways, but I guess that's down to the cast, maybe. I know it's not 1980s, but it has that feel about it. So, yeah, good show.
You know, you said Hilary Swank was annoying, but she's an actress I never really paid attention to. I think she was in a few romantic comedies or whatever, and I was like, I'll stay away from her films. But she's popped up in a number of things that I've watched over the years. And I got into that TV series that she did, Alaska Daily, because I like Alaska a great deal. I've spent a lot of time in Alaska, and I was really quite keen to see that. But the more I see of her, the more I realize that she is a really good actress. I like her a lot. I can't find a bad thing about her at the moment. And I'm sure there are some, but...
Perhaps I should have said her character was annoying. In which case, she is a good actress.
No, I disagree with that. I don't think she was a particularly annoying character. I think she was just a young, naive girl who was hoping for a better life. But you know, looking through her filmography and everything I look at that she was in, I liked that I've seen. I can't see anything that would make me think, no, I'm staying away from Hilary Swank. I don't know why I did that. Maybe it was just the next Karate Kid. That's the only thing I can think. I didn't like that when that came out. But she's a top actress. I want to see more of her. And she made a sci-fi series or movie a couple of years ago that I think we talked about. And she was good in it too. I can't remember what it's called.
No, nor can I. But no, I'm not saying she's not a good actress. I'm just saying that I found her character, of all of them in that film, just annoying. And it was her boyfriend, really, who was trying to make her life by nicking the money and staging a robbery. It was actually quite it was an interesting little plot. I just think they could have done much more with it. That's all.
That's right. She was in The Homesman with Tommy Lee Jones. That's a great Western. Absolutely fantastic. If anyone wants to watch Western, find The Homesman. I love that. Okay. I blazed onto Amazon as soon as I saw it and bought the Blu-ray. It was so good.
Right, okay. Next up is, I bet you've never heard of Ulaya Amamara. No, hang on a minute. Ulaya Amamra.
Surprisingly, no.
This film is called An Animal. And it's a 2024 French film, which is a feminist body horror film set in the macho world of southern France bull running. It follows Nejma, who is played superbly by this girl, Ulaya Amamra. and she plays this girl who's trying to break into the male-dominated world of bullfighting, which is no longer bullfighting. It's this thing called, Razanteur, in which they don't bullfight in the way they used to by killing the bull. They snatch prizes from the bull's horns. I mean, they still taunt the thing, but they don't any longer stab it and try and kill it. So anyway, she's trying to break into this world that is dominated by males. And on her first outing, she actually earns some respect. She does it really well, and she goes out partying with all the blokes around her into the kind of the outback of nowhere. she gets drunk and they give her drugs and blah, blah, blah. She wakes up with no memory the next morning and she's got a cut in her arm and she doesn't, she remembers something about a struggle going on, but she can't really work out what it is. But anyway, soon afterwards, she starts experiencing heightened senses, hallucinations, and her toes fusing into hooves. So this is the kind of body horror bit. And if you don't want to know any more, then skip forward 5 minutes, and because the rest of it's kind of spoilers. It turns into a bit like an American Werewolf in London, really, where she actually there's a transformation sequence where she changes into half human, half bull, to take out revenge against the people that she works out in the end have done wrong by her during this night of partying where it all went kind of pear-shaped. But anyway, the thing is that it is kind of supernatural and a bit silly, but it's made incredibly well. The production of the film is beautifully done, really interesting color and contrast. There's loads of stuff going on, and you know, the in the arena when they're actually fighting the bulls, or you know, taunting the bulls, all of that is shot really well, and it looks like it's them doing it. It doesn't look as though it's stunt people. So that's kind of done quite well. It's really atmospheric. When they start going out at night into the darkness of the woods where these bulls are, are grazing around in the mist and it's kind of very sinister, and they made it up to be not quite a horror film, but just a sinister kind of supernatural thing, which, you know, the body horror bit is where she takes out this transformation and you see her change, and it's not done in any way as well as The American Werewolf in London, but it is done and it kind of works and it's fine. It's a really well-made thriller, and I think it deserves an audience, and so I would recommend it, and I'll put a link in the show notes to my review where it points out where you can see it. So there you go.
Cool. I have to say, yes, I this does sound rather good. I remember you talking about it some time ago and you were having trouble finding English a DVD, yeah, with English subtitles, yeah, or something, or streaming with English subtitles.
I was.
Obviously, you found them, or you learned to speak French.
Yeah. Where did I find it now? I've got a feeling it was a real roundabout route, like on something half illegal. I think it might have been on Daily Motion or something. It was somewhere where uploading is a bit, you know, dubious. Anyway, I think it was really worth the tracking it down. It's a good film.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. All right. Okay, then.
I was going to talk about Seven Snipers, which I hired from the American streaming version of Amazon Prime last week, but I have left the notebook, or well, actually the note taking application hasn't synced across. I wrote some extensive notes, as you probably got the idea. The fog notes were there as well, and I don't have them with me, so I'm going to leave that until the next show, and we'll talk about it then.
No problem. Let's jump straight into coming soon then, and we've got a nice little collection of stuff here this time, if I say so myself.
Well, yes, because you populated it, and I'll let the listeners try and guess which ones I've put in and which ones Ed's put in. We'll start with reading Lolita in Tehran, which is quite an interesting topical movie that's coming up, an Iranian movie about a professor in revolutionary Iran secretly gathers her most dedicated students to read the forbidden classic of Western literature. And this is coming out on July 10th, 2026. And I've got a funny feeling that, Ted, you're excited about this one.
Because Gold Shifty's in it, and as you know, she can do no wrong for me. Gold Shifty Farahani is just such a good actress, and I just zone into whatever she's in. This is a really good vessel for her talent as well, I think. Mm-hmm. It looks like a really powerful and moving film about women in Iran trying to break free of the system through literature in this case. She's got a little reading circle going, and they're symbolically trying to do this, particularly by the circle reading Lolita. And if you watch the trailer, you can see that they come into all sorts of strife and what have you with the authorities because they're doing it. And it's basically talking about the regime in Iran. And I'm not saying that's true or not true, or I don't want to get political about it, but It, as a piece of drama, it certainly looks like it's fairly powerful and moving, and I think I'm looking forward to it very much.
Yeah. Is she going to be in the next Extraction movie? I can't remember if she survived the second one. She's going to be in the third one. Yeah. But yeah, she's a fantastic actress. I'd like to see this as well. It does look quite dramatic and interesting, and It should be thought-provoking, if anything. Yeah,
definitely.
Cool. Next up is Fatherland, which is a German docudrama about the height of the Cold War. Fatherland centers on the relationship between the writer Thomas Mann and his daughter Erica, an actress, writer, and rally driver, as you do, as they embark on a road trip in a black Buick cruiser across the a Germany in ruins. This looks like an upbeat little tale, Ted, starring Sandra Hüller and Hans Zeissler.
It's a Pawlikowski film, and I can never pronounce these Polish names. I'm really sorry, but I was very taken with his work with Cold War and with Ida, and I'll put links in the show notes to those. I also love watching Sandra Hüller, Anatomy of a Fall springs to mind, and the Zone of Interest. I'm not quite sure.
Project Hail Mary.
Yeah, that's right. I'm not really sure what to make of this, to be honest. I don't know who Thomas Mann is or Erica is, but I love the four films that I've just mentioned from this director and writer. So I'm guessing how far wrong can we go? And I'm sure that they'll carry it. The trailer makes it look like it's very much in the style of Cold War and Ida, certainly, and the others, and made in black and white. And most of his work seems to be, and I'm looking forward to it enormously, even though I might need to do a bit of reading up to understand who these people are and what the backdrop is to it. But the trailer makes it look very attractive.
Well, yeah, absolutely. From the trailer, I had a funny feeling this was going to be, I don't know, 3 hours and 40 minutes long or something, but it's a lean 82 minutes, so it might be easy enough to watch. That does look good, I have to say. Okay, I've got a funny feeling you're not the one who put this one in, but Chum is a new... Oh, no, you did.
Come I did, yeah.
Chum is a new film that looks very like something else we've spoken of recently, but I don't think it'll be reviewed. No, I haven't even seen it yet, I suppose. About a newlywed couple who join some friends on a Mediterranean yacht excursion, only to find themselves caught between a predatory shark and a psychopathic killer in their midst, transforming a sun-drenched escape into a fight for survival. It looks like, Dangerous Creatures?
Dangerous Animals
that starred David Courtney. I think it's just a cheap version of that.
Yeah, I think so. The trailer makes it look very much like that. A loony kind of boat owner drugs a group of 20-somethings and then tries to feed them to the sharks. And in Dangerous Animals, he was making a movie to get his rocks off to later. But there was no evidence of the movie being made here. I think we spoke about Dangerous Animals before. I reviewed it on the show, but in this case, it doesn't look as though he's making videos. So I don't know what he's doing. He's probably just a loony Tunes bloke. But yes, you're right. It does look very much like the same story in a roundabout way.
I got the feeling that he was chasing a particular shark, maybe to extract revenge or something. Maybe it killed his mother or something. Ah. His mother was Lorraine Gray from Jaws 4, The Revenge. So Chum is actually Jaws 5, Revenge of the Revenge. Mm. Yeah. Alice Eve stars in this, and she's quite good. I do like her. I remember in Star Trek Into Darkness, which was...
You're like this because it's full of 20 somethings with knockers hanging out.
Oh, that's not fair. Oh shit! Yeah, we're this one. Yeah, I put this in because I was in a good mood that day. Ride or Die is a new mini series that is coming to streaming channel, starring Octavia Spencer and Hannah Waddingham, who are and Bill Nighy's in there as well. So Ted, you should enjoy that. Mm. It appears to be 8 episodes long, and that was the one thing that has made me change my tune about this. But I like the three leads there, and it's an old fashioned action adventure comedy that is one of those spy thrillers that is full of gags and one character who is not quite up to the task and another character who is. Two best friends, Judith and Debbie, discover that Jebby is secretly an assassin. After a hit goes wrong, they go on the run while being targeted by a mysterious enemy, forcing them to confront the secrets between them. Now, I can imagine this being a fairly okay 90-minute ride. However, being 8 episodes long, I can't imagine how they're going to fill the runtime with the kind of patter that's in the trailer. Initially, I just thought this will be so enjoyably silly. It'll do for a Sunday night before you go to work with a beer or a glass of wine with the family. It's arriving on July 15th. And Ted, I want to know if you even managed it through the trailer.
I did manage it through the trailer, but I nearly vomited during it. It's a shame, actually, because yet again, filmmakers have got the makings possibly of a decent thriller, but they've just spoiled it because they've made it in what they think is comedy, and it's just not funny. It's just tedious. And it seems that you mentioned Bill Nighy there. He was in the trailer. He was only in it for 2 minutes. I get the distinct impression that he's going to be a cameo actor in there, really. But I may be wrong. But it just looks, mundane, boring, tedious to me.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'll lap up anything with Octavia Spencer and Hannah Waddingham. I think I'll maybe watch the first episode and gauge it from there. I think by the 8th episode, I'll want them all dead. Right. Next up is... Oh, bugger me, did I put this in? Flippin' heck.
No, I did.
That's okay. No, I did.
Only because we saw her. We saw her at the end of the last Superman film.
I didn't watch the last Superman film. Superman 4 was the last Superman film.
In the very last scene of the last Superman film, she pops up in a little kind of cameo role right at the death. And it's a bit of a tease for this film coming up, Supergirl.
Okay. I'm a bit confused. There's so many different Superman and Supergirls and all sorts of things going on at the moment. I don't know what I'm supposed to be watching if I were to enter into the comic book fray. But do tell us about this trailer.
Well, it just looks stupid to me. I used to like Superman. I thought when they put the character in amongst Earthlings in the old days and he did his thing, like in the comics of the 19, whatever it was, it was great. It was fun and it was in amongst. Now it seems they're putting these characters into the middle of some other universe or other world or time or whatever it is. And it just all becomes this kind of high tech CGI stuff, like, you know, some other genre, really, and ends up being a far-fetched load of twaddle. I'm sure that the target audience of the average 12 and 13-year-old in the summer blockbuster will enjoy it, and it'll appeal to them, and they'll have great fun with it. But to be honest, after watching this this trailer, I just thought to myself, I'm not even going to watch this. I suppose Millie, we got fans of Millie Alcock who probably will watch it, haven't we? I'm trying to think what I know her from now. Do you know the name?
No, I'm actually on the TV series of Supergirl that has Melissa Benoist as Supergirl. And was there not one that had the Batman in it as well? Or was that Batgirl? Oh, I don't... I've lost.
I can't remember what I know Millie Alcock from now, but there's something... We've spoken about her on this very show. Well, not this one, but this very series of shows.
And she's in House of the Dragon.
Right.
Sirens, which is a TV series.
Oh, she was in Game of Thrones. Oh, okay. Perhaps it was Alan, because he was a big Game of Thrones man.
She's not in Game of Thrones. She's in House of the Dragon.
Oh, right.
Which is the follow-up show. Get your Game of Thrones right. People will get annoyed.
I don't fancy the look of it, and it looks all very silly, but we'll see.
Well, you're on your own there. I checked out of superhero movies. The last one I watched, which I enjoyed, was The Shadow. Right, the last one is Evil Dead Burn.
Woohoo!
Because we're getting a new Evil Dead film. It's coming out in just under a month. It looks fantastic. It's getting cut, which I suppose the only thing that I'm taking away from that is that we're going to get a nice big unrated Blu-ray or 4K to go in there. But yes, this looks like one of the best horror films ever made, and I can't wait. After the loss of her husband, a woman seeks solace with her in-laws as one by one they transform into deadites, which are the type of zombie things that are in Evil Dead series. She comes to discover that that the vows that she took for life survive even in death, which is a new twist on all things Evil Dead. Evil Dead is a series of films that, Ted, you often asked, is there a series of films that are just always good, that don't have a bad entry? And Evil Dead is that series of films. All of them are superb.
Okay. I've seen the first one, but yet again, I saw it at the cinema when it came out.
To be honest, the first one is actually the weakest of the lot, I would go as far to say. Some people might disagree with that, but I feel that that's echoed throughout all the fans. Everything is just, you know, it's one of those franchises where it's impossible to say which one you like the best because they're all so good.
Okay. Let me have a look. What year was the first one? 81?
81, yeah. Well, 70 if you really want to go with it.
Okay.
And Within the Woods was before that, so it was actually the first one, just to be really nerdy about things.
I think I have watched that twice. I watched it at the cinema, and I seem to remember in the last decade I probably watched it again sometime, yeah.
And there you go. You're going to be watching Mad Max 2, the Evil Dead franchise, and something else.
Very, very busy chap. Okay, yes. So you've written on your blog about this film, haven't you? do you want to just trail that?
No, I'm not submerging my blog in Evil Dead stuff, but I'm keeping a close eye on things and trying to generate a bit of excitement for it, because I think it's going to be one of the best horror movies of the year. But then I'm absolutely biased because, you know, I know Bruce and I know Sam Raimi and I know Robert Tapert and things like that. So, yeah, it's one film to go out and watch.
Okay, right. I'll link to that in the show notes anyway, so people can go and have a read of what you've written. Right, before we go then, let's head for the final curtain and see if I've heard of any of these people.
All right, well, we'll start off with one who lives just down the road from you, in Cardiff in Wales, and that's Owen Rhys-Davies, who passed away on May 27th. So it's quite some time ago, but he was in Twin Peaks, the recent Twin Peaks, not the old one, because I don't think he would have been alive then, given his age. And he's in Alice Through the Looking Glass and The Relationship and A Serial Killer's Guide to Life. Impact Winter was one of his last things. He's still got two films in the pipe that are due to come out called La Fascinia and Jeff the Killer. But Ted, you watched through Twin Peaks, I think, didn't you?
No, I didn't. I watched the original Twin Peaks a bit. I don't know this person. And I have looked through his filmography, and there's nothing that he's been in that I've seen. It's just a bit shocking, really, that he's died at 44. I don't know what the backstory of that is, but that's no age at all, and that's very sad. But no, sorry, I don't know him.
Fair enough. The next one we lost is George Lucas's ex-wife. And that's Marcia Lucas. Now, she is particularly notable because she edited Star Wars. And that, I think, is quite important. She also did American Graffiti and Taxi Driver as well. So she was a well-renowned editor of note. She didn't edit that many films. She kind of stopped after Return of the Jedi. I think she is wholly responsible for turning Star Wars from a hokey sci-fi film into something quite spectacular. And she deserves an awful lot of credit for her work on A New Hope and The Empire Strikes Back. Mm. Absolutely. And American Graffiti as well, which is, it's no dozer there. That's a great movie. So it was very sad to hear of her passing away. And it was of cancer, unfortunately.
At the age of 80. Again, I'm afraid I don't know the lady, but I have seen American Graffiti. In fact, American Graffiti's in our private screening somewhere. Where did we put that? It was up.
Oh,
it was
very
quite
high.
Yeah. So we have done American Graffiti already, and also of course Taxi Driver. I know really well. You know, I've watched that numerous amounts of times, an editor of films, I suppose, is someone that's not really in your face. And, you know, the fact that I've not heard of her and don't know her probably isn't that unusual for the average film watcher. You're not going to really know who the editor of the film is, are you? Or am I wrong?
No, you're right. They are a bit like stumped persons. I would put them up there with the unsung heroes of films, because a fraction of a section or a second in a scene is make or break for that scene. You know, being able to pace the film in such a way to be able to keep things moving. It's an art, an absolute art. And I think where you go to maybe Italy and look at a Star Wars knockoff, the editing of those films is generally terrible, but you watch A New Hope and just how it moves, and especially Empire Strikes Back, because it is one of the greatest movies ever made. I know some people don't like Star Wars anymore, and people can poo-poo Star Wars now, but Empire Strikes Back is a genuine great film.
Some of us have never seen any of them.
All right, okay. Well, you should absolutely watch those two, because you boil it down, they are great movies at the heart of it. And American Graffiti again is another one that just it lived because of the cuts that she made, the incisions that she made, the timing, and the arrangement of all the scenes. Now, obviously, George Lucas has a lot of input into that as well, but it's her craft that makes it all work for him to achieve what he wants, just as much as a production designer, just as much as a set decorator, a makeup artist, all that kind of thing. It takes them all to get together and make this. It's not just George Lucas. He would stand there and take all the credit, but it was all the smaller people who actually brought it all together, and her contribution is invaluable. In fact, whenever it comes to George Lucas's talent, given his movie, his Phantom Menace and all that kind of, the subsequent series of Star Wars films, I think a lot more credit needs to be given to everyone else who worked behind the scenes on that film. And he was just lucky. I think he'll be the first one to admit that he was lucky too.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. All right, the last one we're going to talk about is a name that you might not recognize, but by gum, you'll know it, many of the films that he is in. James Handy. I particularly know him from Arachnophobia and The Rocketeer, but he's also in Jumanji and both Top Gun films. I know he's in Maverick, but I can't remember if he's in the original Top Gun as well. But yes, he's a really, really recognizable character actor who dates right back to the maybe even the 60s. I know from the 70s. Well, no, the 80s, the early 80s. Taps, that's right, he was in Taps. And it just appeared in hundreds of films over the years because he was just a good, reliable character actor. Oh, he was in French Connection 3. There we go. Some people are going to go, what? But yes, he was in Popeye Doyle. Yeah, what a phenomenal filmography he has. Ted, I'm sure you got to recognize many of these, and you might even recognize his face whenever you see it.
Kind of rings a distant bell, his face, but really not on my radar. But I have seen stuff he's been in, like Arachnophobia I watched years ago, Jumanji I watched years ago, Unbreakable I liked, and I'd have to revisit that to see who he was playing in that. But looking at his filmography, he's just been in tons and tons of American TV shows, and as you know, they don't particularly end up on my radar unless someone like you points them out to me. But yeah, amazing career, and 81 he was by the looks of it.
Yeah. Actually, he was in 15 Minutes that we were talking about a couple of weeks ago as one of the recommendations. I think you were going to disappear off and watch that. Obviously, you didn't.
No, I forgot all about that.
Yeah. But it's very sad to hear of his passing, but we have a huge amount of films to enjoy that he contributed to over the years.
Yes, indeed. Okay, that's it. We're done then. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another show. And don't forget that you can check out Gareth's blog that we were talking about earlier and all the other stuff he does at garethmiles.com. Projectorroom.co.uk is where our website is, and links to all the stuff we're doing there. Or if you get lost there, you can get to Podhub UK or even tedsalmon.com, where there's links to absolutely everything, including my blog as well, all the podcasts and all the MeWe groups and everything else. So there we have it. And we hope you've enjoyed the show, and we'll be back in a fortnight, and we hope that you'll join us then once again in the projector room.